You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Last Sunday, Iraqi voters went to the polls in the first elections held since the country became a sovereign nation. And earlier today, some preliminary results were announced. Joining me now from Baghdad to explain what the partial results and the election in general mean for Iraq is Anthony Shadid, foreign correspondent for The New York Times. I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show today. Hi.
Good. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Partial results were announced earlier today and showed that Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki is leading. Should we be surprised?
Well, I think we should be surprised by how much he's leading. And rather, if we can even say how much he's leading at this point, there's a lot of confusion out there today. There's been some delays in some preliminary results. The release of the results we heard today were just from five provinces, and they were very partial at that. There's already a lot of speculation that's going on about who won and who lost. And the one thing we're sure of is that it's a tight race, perhaps tighter than we had expected before the election. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki was looking for a popular mandate. It doesn't look like he's gotten that so far. Again, it's early results, but it does seem to be much tighter, much more contested than we thought it might have been.
And aren't they from strongholds for the prime minister? So if the results are close, what can we expect when the rest of the results come in?
Well, you're exactly right in pointing out the stronghold. The south and the two biggest cities in Iraq, Baghdad and Basra, were the real battleground for the prime minister. He needed to do better than the rival Shiite coalition that he decided not to join before the vote. It looks closer than we expected down there. He seems to have done well in Baghdad and Basra, but in the countryside and the more rural areas of southern Iraq, it's a much closer race. The key here is that Maliki does not get that popular mandate, if he doesn't emerge with a decisive or clear victory, he's going to have much less of a hand to deal with in trying to become the next prime minister. There have already been rumors and speculation that a consensus candidate might emerge. They're already starting negotiations over what shape a government might take. But it does look like, as of now at least, and before we see the final results, that Maliki may be in a weaker position than we thought he might have been.
And a coalition of Shiite parties publicly questioned the vote counting process before the results were announced today. Were they concerned there was some hanky-panky?
Well, that's one of the concerns out there, and it's probably going to gather more attention in the coming days. And yet Alawi, who kind of emerged as a secular candidate, in some ways as the default Sunni candidate in the elections, his people organized a press conference today and made that charge, that there was vote tampering, that there was fraud. Now, it's going to depend on how strident they are in these accusations. There have been reports of this since the very beginning, but it's unclear about how much fraud has actually happened. If one of the main coalitions in this election charges fraud, though, or says it won't accept the legitimacy of the results, it could throw an already confused place in the further tumult.
Has there been any sense of an Iraqi reaction to the results so far?
It's remarkable when you drive around in the streets in Baghdad and talk to people. There's an incredible amount of anticipation out there about these results. People are, it's the topic of almost every conversation. Police at checkpoints ask, drivers if they've heard about the latest results. It definitely is the talk of the town right now. I think as this drags on, it could become, maybe less enthusiastic and become more suspicious. There have been questions out there if foreign powers are going to interfere in this election. There are always suspicions of vote fraud. And so I think if we drag this on before we get a clearer picture, if preliminary results take too long, you might see the mood shift a little bit. It might shift from anticipation to something a little bit more troubling.
Originally, weren't some results expected late yesterday? Why does the whole process take so long? In most countries, complete results are in within a day or two, sometimes within hours.
What we understand from election officials is that all the votes have been counted, in fact. It's just the logistical challenge of compiling these millions of votes. A computer apparently crashed yesterday at the electoral headquarters. You're exactly right. They have delayed. When we first heard that we're going to get preliminary results on Wednesday, we're going to get them today at noon. It's evening time in Baghdad right now, and they still haven't come out. It's very partial results from just five provinces, far short of what we've been promised, which is 30% from across the country. They say it's a logistical challenge. That may be right. But as I pointed out, things aren't always taken at face value here. It is a suspicious place. And I think as this as this drags on, people are going to worry that there's some manipulation going on.
Is it even possible to gauge the impact of the election yet, or will it take us months to see what the significance of Sunday's vote really is?
You know, it's been kind of, the popular wisdom out there before the election is that, you know, the election was one thing and the negotiations that took place after it were an entirely different thing. If you look back to 2006, after the first parliamentary election, it took 156 days to cobble together a coalition government. You know, what we're seeing right now is a shift from maybe even a year ago. A year ago after local elections, you know, elections for provincial councils, Maliki seemed to have the upper hand. He emerged as the single most important leader in the country. What we're seeing now, if this bears out, again, it's very early and you don't want to draw too many conclusions, but if you do see that Maliki has a weaker hand, you know, you're going to have an even more fractured political landscape, a lot more wheeling and dealing, a lot more negotiation. And I think there might be a little bit of anxiety out there in the street over what this interim period is going to mean.
Ayad Alawi, the man you mentioned earlier, the former prime minister, also a Shiite? I think that we just lost the connection to Baghdad. We were talking with Anthony Shadid, the foreign correspondent for the New York Times. He is talking to us in Baghdad about Iraq's parliamentary elections. And we are hoping to reconnect with him very soon. Hi, Anthony, you're back.
Fine, sorry about that.
Okay, well, these things happen. We're speaking to that. You know, when you do a phone call to Baghdad, you don't expect the line to be as good as when you're talking to someone in Brooklyn.
That's right. I'm pretty delighted how good it is so far.
Well, I was asking about Ayad Alawi, the former prime minister. He is also a Shiite, isn't he? But he's a more secular Shiite?
That's right. He is a secular Shiite, former prime minister, interim prime minister. He was a prime minister when the U.S. was still, when the U.S. still had sovereignty, the U.S. was in control of the country. Ayad Alawi was an interesting character in this election. People, you know, some people here are wary of predicting his success. I think a lot of journalists have been burned in the past and predicting him doing better than he actually did in the end. But it has been not necessarily a strong campaign, but he does seem to have captured a current here. It's a secular current. He's also done incredibly well in the Sunni areas, apparently, by these preliminary results. And so you do have kind of an irony of a secular Shiite emerging as the default Sunni leader in the negotiations we're getting ready for.
Well, he campaigned on overcoming sectarian divisions. So I guess Sunnis who would have preferred to have had some Sunni candidates who were disqualified but who still wanted to vote saw him as the more reasonable option.
I think that's right. You know, when I was in Anbar in Fallujah, which is a predominantly Sunni area in western Iraq, the scene of some of the worst days of the insurgency, and often people would describe Alawi as kind of the best of the worst. There's a notion out there, I think it's a tactical choice by many Sunni voters, that they are not going to have a Sunni prime minister anytime soon. They want to have a Shiite prime minister that is secular, that might stand up to Iran, that would stand up to the religious Shiite parties. And I think a lot of people saw Alawi as the default candidate in some ways. He's not a very aggressive campaigner. He's not, he's accused of having a certain high-handedness. But I think he was, in the eyes of a lot of Sunni voters out there, the best option they had at the moment.
You talked about all the deal-making. As that deal-making draws out, is there a greater risk of violence from groups that may feel that they're being treated badly or shortchanged?
Yeah, there's one thing I think we've learned over the years in Iraq is that there's a certain set of rules that have been laid down, but there's not a conviction that those rules are necessarily going to be followed. And I think what you have seen in the past is violence is sometimes used as a tool in negotiations. I think, you know, on one hand, the insurgents, although somewhat subdued, there's still a presence there. They may take advantage of a situation in which the government is not in full control. I don't think you can put it past parties themselves, even figures in these negotiations, to somehow employ violence as a way to increase leverage or put pressure on their rivals and try to get the deal that they want.
I'm assuming that a more fractured political landscape almost guarantees that there'll be an uptick in violence.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that also, it goes to a question a lot of people have asked. If Maliki had returned as prime minister, he may again. It's still so early to say, and we really don't know where Maliki's power is right now or how Maliki fared in these elections conclusively. But if Maliki had returned as prime minister, he wouldn't have had that challenge of one government stepping down and another government coming to power. Maliki would have basically continued what he's, you know, in the position he's been for the past 4 years. If it does turn out that Maliki loses power, there's another candidate for prime minister, it's going to be a real test of the institutions of this country, whether they can handle the transfer of power, whether Maliki and the people he's seated throughout the ministries, throughout the military, if these people are willing to surrender power and make way for another government.
Well, we've been talking about Shiites and Sunnis, but the Kurds have about 20 to 25% of the seats in parliament. Does that make them the swing group when it comes to forming a coalition?
It definitely makes them one of the swing groups here. I think the Kurds, again, when we talk about the fractured landscape, the Kurds are another great example of this. You know, in the past negotiations of a government back in 2005 and 2006, the Kurds had a united front that dropped to Baghdad, and they were able to become a part of the government. In some ways, you know, the concessions from their negotiating partners. What you've seen in the Kurdish vote this time is, again, more division. There's a dissident group from the two parties, the Kurdistan since 2003. There's also an Islamist vote up there. And so instead of having one front, you almost have four fronts. And there's going to be a question, I think, in the weeks ahead if the Kurds can negotiate among themselves to bring a united front to the table or not. There's already speculation that some of the Arab negotiating partners are going to try to peel off a portion of that Kurdish vote into some future coalition.
So we're seeing an erosion of the cohesion that played such a major role in Iraqi politics, at least until now, until this election. Now, there were 6,100...
You're right, and I think that's one...
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think that's a great point to make, but I mean, it's almost one way to see what's happened with this election. And you know, I keep cautioning because I don't want to be too conclusive about what we're seeing, but, you know, this erosion of what were very kind of dominant blocks back in 2005 and 2006 simply aren't there anymore. She had to divide it between two coalitions, one led by the prime minister, the other led by traditional religious Shiite parties. Allowed it to merge in a way in the Sunni areas that we hadn't seen before, and we see divisions among the Kurds as well. So the color of fractured landscape probably understates a little bit. In some ways, it's a very confusing landscape. And, you know, the negotiations are going to be almost certain negotiations from anything at this point.
My guest is Anthony Shadid of The New York Times. He's foreign correspondent for The New York Times, and he is currently in Baghdad. We're talking to him about Iraq's parliamentary elections last Sunday and what we can ascertain from the partial results that have come in so far. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Anthony Shadid, foreign correspondent for The New York Times, talking to us from Baghdad. Anthony, it sounds like we have a better connection.
I think we do.
Yeah. There were 6,100 candidates on the ballot on Sunday, but hundreds of Sunni candidates were excluded. Do you think that the controversy over those candidates had an impact on Sunday?
You know, I think it may have had an ironic impact in some ways. You know, I think a lot of Sunni voters, when these candidates were barred in the first place, there was a lot of anger out there, disenchantment with the process, a feeling that odds were stacked against them. But I think what we found on the day of the election itself was that Sunnis turned out in far greater numbers than we had expected. In a place like Anbar province, where the insurgency was so powerful back in 2004 and 2005, only, I think, 40% of people had voted in elections last year. This time we saw more than 60% vote. So I think in some ways there was actually a desire on the part of Sunni to have a voice, to try to change the negotiations through the ballot box, and that was somewhat interesting and somewhat surprising.
Well, there had been quite a few Sunnis involved in the boycott of the previous election, and there was talk of a boycott here. But as you point out, that largely didn't happen, despite the fact that there was a certain amount of violence to dissuade people from going to the polls?
That's right. There was a lot of violence. I was in Fallujah the day of the election, and there were probably about 20 bombings or so. You know, when you talk to police, it turns out those bombs were often sound bombs. They were, you know, things, kind of small explosives thrown into trash cans. And it turns out that no one was killed in Anbar. You did see this big turnout that we didn't expect. I think the one thing that people are going to want to watch as we go forward is, you know, Sunnis did turn out to vote. Ayad Alawi, the secular Shiite former prime minister that we've talked about, polled very well in these areas, apparently. But can he hold his coalition together? Can he bring a united front to the negotiations in Baghdad? And there are already indications that his coalition may fracture, and may fracture rather quickly. That could lead us to a problem again in the months down the road, where Sunnis find themselves with not a cohesive voice, with not as strong a position as they might have wanted in these negotiations that are getting ready to start.
Secretary of Defense Robert Gates said on Sunday that the relatively peaceful elections were a sign of how far Iraq has come. Do you see it that way? Do Iraqis see it that way?
Well, you know, I think we have to remember, you know, the Americans played down the violence that happened here in Baghdad on Election Day, but there were still more than 100 attacks here. 38 people died. You know, it wasn't one of the bloodier days in Baghdad, but it was still quite a violent day. You know, I think the Americans had a lot of symbolic importance attached to this election. This, in a lot of ways, was a milestone for their plans to withdraw from the country. The Obama administration has made clear that this is not its war, and it is leaving. You know, by August, I think we're going to see just 50,000 troops here. Now, how we define them, are they combat troops or not combat troops, that's going to be pretty elastic. But there is a sense that the Americans are leaving. You know, what kind of country they're leaving behind is probably something we can't answer for, you know, perhaps 5 or 10 years. I think one thing we can say, though, is that the Americans have proven very successful at organizing elections. The governments that have followed these elections, though, have not been all that successful. They haven't proven that they can govern all that well. And I think we have a country right now that doesn't have the violence it once had 2 or 3 years ago, but it also doesn't have the institutions, the political institutions, the security institutions that it needs to have a stable state. So there's a little bit of a discrepancy between the trappings of democracy and the institutions of a democratic state here.
With that in mind, what did Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki campaign on?
It was, you know, he campaigned on exactly what he campaigned a year ago, and that was law and order, basically. He was a strongman candidate. He was here to restore a semblance of civility to life in Baghdad and elsewhere, and he was going to rule the state with a heavy hand, a place that I think a lot of Iraqis, an idea that a lot of Iraqis found attractive. Maliki ran on the same platform he ran a year ago, but it's been less of a dramatic change here over the past year. You know, back in 2009, when he did very well in local elections, there was a dramatic change in the violence that we had seen in 07 and 08 and what we were seeing in 09. You know, over the past year, it's been more of the same in some ways. And we've had some very spectacular attacks in August, October, December, and January. But that shook, I think, a lot of people's confidence in how well the state was doing and, you know, in creating the stability that people longed for. You know, I think the tarnish may, you know, Maliki's image may have been a little tarnished over the past year, and it was a little tough for him to run on the exact same platform that he had before.
Was there a need for him to be seen by Iraqis as standing up to the American presence?
You know, I think he tried that at one point, and he angered the Americans. I mean, I heard it from the Americans themselves that they thought he overplayed it in June. It is still a state where the Americans have an incredible amount of influence. And I think even as they withdraw, we have to remind ourselves that this is the largest American embassy in the world. There's still, you know, right now a little less than 100,000 troops here. The Americans have a big, they still play a very big role in here. And I think Maliki understands that he has to make peace with that role that the Americans are playing. It is interesting when you don't hear, you know, in the street, when you're doing street interviews, when you're talking to people, when you're even talking to politicians, the Americans don't come up in conversation the way they once did. Often it's Iran that comes up more than the Americans, in fact. And, you know, I think it is just a shift in the kind of the political arithmetic here, that as the Americans leave, their influence, while still great, diminishes. You know, there are other concerns to voters. It's a remarkably different feel than I think you saw even 2 years ago here.
Well, al-Maliki is seen as being somewhat pro-Iranian, but Iran has said that it sees him as being out of their control. I would assume they would do that if they felt that he was a friend, just so that they wouldn't affect the vote. How much of a role has Iranian influence played on the campaign?
You know, the Iranians are a very sophisticated player here. They obviously have legitimate national interests. I mean, Iraq is their neighbor. And the Iranians have a great deal of influence through what you might call soft power, personal connections, economic relationships.
But also, what about religion? These are the only two Shiite majority countries in the Middle East.
You know, ruled by, absolutely, Iraq is the only state that's ruled by the Shiite majority. I think what the Iranians' interest here in the elections, and we speak about the elections in particular, is to keep some kind of Shiite unity. I think they were angered that Maliki, the prime minister, went off on his own and didn't join the main Shiite coalition. And I think what we're going to see after the election is pressure on Maliki from the Iranians to somehow restore that Shiite unity in some kind of coalition government.
Your former colleague at the Washington Post, Tom Ricks, was on our show last month, and he said, and I'm paraphrasing, that the elections will tell us the shape of post-American Iraq, whether it will fall apart or whether we'll see the political breakthrough that the surge promised. Do you agree with him?
I think this will be the first and perhaps not the second.
No, the surge, you don't see the surge as having worked?
You know, what I would think is we'll understand that if things fail here. Things could unravel pretty quickly. Will we understand, will we see success as quickly? I think that's a tougher call. I think that's something that might wait till even the next government after this one. We're talking 5 or 10 years. Again, it's a question of institutions here. What kind of institutions are the Americans leaving behind that can prove their durability? And it's a really tough question to answer right now. I think if anything, we don't see durable institutions. We often see those institutions manipulated for political aims. You know, it is a semblance of a state here, but how deep that state runs is a question that we can't answer now. You know, like I said, it might not be a question we can answer for 5 or 10 years.
Well, right before Sunday's vote, President Obama reiterated that the outcome of the elections would not affect plans to pull out in August. But is there any result that might make the White House change its plans?
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, short of an Iranian invasion, I think the Americans are leaving. I mean, especially when you're in Baghdad, you just, you know, when I used to see American, armored vehicles rolling down the streets of Baghdad just a year ago, you don't see that anymore. Of course, they withdrew from the city 6 months ago. But even when you go to bases or talk to the American military, you know, it's not a war anymore in their eyes. I mean, they call it, I think the euphemism is stability operations. But we are seeing, you know, the end coming to what was, you know, in the beginning an occupation, and after that was an incredible amount of American power here. It's hard for me to see anything short of, like I said, an invasion or an utter collapse in this country to change the minds of the administration or the American military. That said, though, there is going to be an American presence here, and it is, you know, it is a country that has, you know, I think greater American, or the Americans exert more influence here. I mean, I might be stating the obvious, but more American influence here than any other country I can think of in the region.
Really, even more than Afghanistan? Is there, because the focus seems to be on Afghanistan, and I wonder what Iraqis feel about that. Are they relieved or are they concerned?
You know, I guess it's how you define influence. I mean, there is more of a semblance of a state here than I think in Afghanistan. So, I mean, if you define it as military influence, no, there would be more in Afghanistan. It's interesting. In Iraq, people don't. You ask this question, whether they talk about Afghanistan. And, you know, I think people are so overwhelmed by their own problems they're facing here in Iraq that it really doesn't come up in conversation that much. Even politics in the rest of the Arab world are often not talked about all that much. I think there's a sense here that, you know, just the very, you know, basics of daily life, you know, water and sewage and electricity and livelihood. These are so overwhelming for so many people that they really dominate the scene.
Is it your sense that Iraqis are eager to see this drawdown of U.S. troops?
Yeah, the Americans definitely left a mixed legacy here. I mean, I don't think, you know, if you ask somebody, was, you know, the American invasion a good thing, you're going to get a mixed answer on that. I mean, this country has gone through, you know, just through awful horrors, you know, hundreds of thousands dead. The very fabric of the society was torn apart, and it hasn't been mended. I mean, it's still a country where these sectarian and ethnic divisions, where this notion of loss runs very deep, and you hear it, in conversations all the time. It's hard to meet an Iraqi who hasn't lost a relative or a friend to the violence. So, you know, it's a broken place still, and in a lot of respects. And I think, you know, the flip side of that is, do the Americans provide some stability right now? I think a lot of Iraqis would say, you know, that they do, and it makes people anxious when they leave. So, it's very conflicted, and I think it's often very ambiguous when you ask people about how, you know, how they feel about the Americans being here, how they feel about the Americans leaving. And it causes so many different sentiments. I think, you know, sentiments of, you know, fear and nationalism and, you know, hope and ambitions. It's a very complicated place.
I hate to ask prediction questions because they never pan out, but what do you think we can expect in the next few weeks as the results continue to come in?
I think, you know, we're going to hear, you know, as they say in Arabic, you're going to hear a lot of noise here, you know, going forward. I think it's going to be, I think we're going to hear more, you know, accusations of fraud. I think we're going to see people not willing to lose necessarily. You know, how far that goes is the real thing to watch. I mean, do people contest the legitimacy of the results? And if they do, it could get very messy here. If they don't, I think we're going to start, we're going to embark on these negotiations that I've been talking about over the next coalition government. It's going to take a while. It's going to be protracted. There, you know, people are going to walk away from the negotiating table at times, and there's going to be some brinkmanship. But I think if they can get past the legitimacy of the returns of the votes themselves, then we're probably on a path that most people were expecting, and that's coming up with a new government.
Anthony, thank you so much for talking with us again. Anthony Shadid is the foreign correspondent for the New York Times in Baghdad, and we've been talking to him from Baghdad. It's been a real pleasure.
It's my pleasure. It's always good to join you.